All right, everybody, welcome back to Reclaim the Present podcast. We have a very interesting and I would say powerful podcast coming up today. I have Colleen with me.
Hello, everyone.
And I got to tell you, I was taken back when I caught this individual on LinkedIn. He put a message on LinkedIn that was probably one of the most jaw-dropping things that I've seen in quite some time. And I just had to have an opportunity to speak with this gentleman. I want to introduce you to Detective Scott Rung. He serves the Benton County Sheriff's Office in the ICAC Task Force. That's Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force, Washington State. Welcome, Scott.
Thank you so much. I appreciate this.
Oh, man. When I say it is an honor and a privilege from my background, from what I've gone through personally in my own journey, when I came across that post that you put on LinkedIn, I just had to speak with you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's funny. I got your message on that. And when I posted that, I literally thought, if this reaches 30 people, I'd be happy. That's all I really cared to do. And I didn't expect it to be, resonate with so many people. And, I'm glad that it brought me the opportunity to talk to you.
Yeah. Yeah. And we're looking forward to digging into it. So kind of the way that I was thinking about going is a little bit chronological. If you feel good to talk about it, where you grew up type thing and digging into what got you into where you're at. And then I'd like to touch base on the LinkedIn conversation, of course, and then dig into your specialty. How's that sound?
Yeah, no, I'm fine with it. If I don't know. I mean, I'm a pretty open person, so I really don't mind talking about my history. In fact, I've embraced a lot of it. As long as I'm not crossing any lines or anything along those lines, I'd be fine with it.
Fantastic. Okay, so where did you grow up?
So I grew up. I was born in Washington State. My father was a young kid in the Army. So over by Fort Lewis, Washington. My family was from the Tri-Cities, Washington, which is southeast in the state. So when people think Washington, they naturally think Seattle or pine trees and forest. And I actually grew up in what's called the Columbia Basin, which is the desert of Washington. Uh-huh. I spent my childhood here. We are famous for the nuclear reservation that we have. We built the plutonium for the first nuclear bomb that was used. So my area was desolate and nothing here. Over the years I've lived here, I've watched it grow leaps and bounds. It's pretty good size area. Now we probably pushing about 300,000 in our population, and we're one of the fastest growing areas. I think probably because we're just kind of a unique built town.
Cool. Now growing up, your father was in the service. What did your mom and dad do? Were they both service members or?
No, it was kind of an odd. So you asked me how I got into the specialty field and how I got here. You know, unfortunately, I love my parents. My parents are honestly, they're still with us. They're actually very young. So my parents are almost like older siblings. My dad was 19 when he had me. My mother just turned 19. My dad just turned 20 after me. Okay. So they were kids.
Yeah.
They had rough childhoods, very bad ones. There was a lot of sexual abuse in my mother's life. My father, he left home probably around 17, ran away, dropped out of high school, finished his degree in the Army. He just knew he had to join the military. He'd probably go to jail. So very poor, didn't have a lot to come up on, but they were both just absolute fighters. They just kept, this isn't going to be enough for us. This isn't going to be enough for any of us. And they just put their nose to the grindstone and just worked, and so I'm an only child. So people are always like, you must be just spoiled, rotten. I'm like, no, I think we were just so poor. We couldn't afford another kid. So, that's just kind of how things were, but we came up in this nice little home and life was pretty good that way. And my mom, she kind of did some various secretarial jobs. My dad worked at the grain elevator. And eventually he made his way over to that Hanford reservation working what's called Hanford Patrol, which is their security operations. My grandfather also worked out there at that time. And that's kind of where he got his first experience of law enforcement. We had a neighbor that was a police officer, and eventually my father went on to be a reserve police officer and then a Kennewick police officer.
Okay.
So yeah, it kind of went that way. My parents divorced back in 1987. So there's kind of a unique story there. And back when I was a child, unfortunately, I was sexually molested as a child by a family member. Yeah. And, you know, I'm not talking about anything like grotesque or graphic. It was inappropriate touching. And I went through, you know, but I was one of the scenarios where if you tell your family, you're going to get in trouble too. And I was like, I don't know, 3 or 4 at the time when it happened. So I never said anything.
Yeah.
And I remember I was watching Saturday morning cartoons when I was 9 years old. And Bill Cosby, of all people, came on there talking about, hey, if you're ever touched inappropriately, you should tell a parent. So I remember distinctly, I told my mother on a car ride what happened, and I felt guilty, and I started crying. And my mom just, she just had a tough time with it. And it resonated everything that happened to her as a child and her as a teenager. And she blamed herself, and she became very sick, bipolar manic depressant. Oh, and wow. Back in those days, they didn't know how to treat it per se.
Yeah.
You know, this is like the time when lithium is just coming out, and she had to be hospitalized a couple of times, and my dad didn't know what to do. My mom didn't know what to do. And eventually it kind of drove them to divorce because of the circumstances that was occurring. And they both have their own side of the story of what happened. But, you know, unfortunately, it was an unfortunate event. My situation kind of went by the wayside because my mom was so off the rails at that time that, you know, all the focus was on her. So it just kind of never got mentioned again, which, you know, being an only child, I didn't have anybody to talk to about it. We had to go live with my grandparents for a year while my dad tried to figure out finances. He eventually got remarried and I was about 12 years old. And, you know, and then we went back to living. So for me, it had a very negative connotation to ever report anything like that because my whole life went upside down just by simply saying, hey, this is something that happened to me.
Yeah.
And, I never talked about it, probably not until I was 29, before I ever mentioned it again. I went through a lot of pain through that. So there was a lot of trying to figure out how to deal with those type things. You know, it was just back in those days, you might remember that, you know, it was easier to, because it was a family member, It was easier to sweep things under the rug rather than talk about it because it's impolite or nobody wants to talk about those things. Yeah. So yeah, it kind of caused chaos in my life. And, you know, so I just became a very quiet kid because of a lot of that stuff. But, you know, I mean, I adjusted. You know, I went to high school and I played football and I got out and I tried college. And I just know that I'm just the worst student when it comes to things I don't want to really learn about. And street smart, just not really book smart. And that's when I knew that for me, the best possibility was probably to join the Army. So I left Washington State in 1996, and I joined the Army, and I actually was stationed in Louisiana for about 4 years, which, you know, I still consider like a second home down there. The people were so kind and friendly, and I have a lot of good memories from there. And I was in for about 5 years with only one deployment to Honduras, and then I came back home, and I was an MP in the Army Military Police Officer.
Okay.
And you know, I think the worst thing you could do is give an 18-year-old a gun and a badge. you think you're Chuck Norris and you don't have the emotional capability to deal with actual pain and everything. So it just scared the death out of me. And I got out. My dad's like, oh, be a cop. And I'm like, I don't want to be a cop. That was awful. It was just not for me. And I tried school again and again, just miserable. It wasn't for me. And then a job at the jail opened up at the sheriff's office. And I decided, well, you know, maybe just like not liking people with black and white stripes on, maybe that would be the easier way to go. And I tested and I got the job with the Benton County Sheriff's Office as a corrections officer. And after about 4.5 years of that, I realized I don't like being incarcerated with people. So it was kind of a tough go. But yeah, then I kind of went into this depression of like, oh my gosh, I don't know what I'm going to do with my life. I'm so just confused with everything. And I started asking the other cops because the cops would come to the jail and book their people in. And I was like, how much do you get paid doing this? And like, and they told me the amount, which was like 3 times more than what I was making. And I'm like, when do you get to retire? And like 53 in Washington State. And I'm like, sold. I just like, you know, I don't know what I want to do with my life, but I know I don't want to work forever. So, you know, that sounds like a pretty sweet deal. And yeah, I tested and Benton County Sheriff Larry Taylor at the time knew me from the corrections side, and he hired me, and I started my road as a deputy, and quickly figured out how much I loved it. But I was horrible at writing tickets because I just felt so guilty because, I mean, I'm speeding around on my time, and I'm just like, oh, I can't write people tickets when I'm speeding as well. So I found out that I loved investigations, and I liked solving crimes. And I knew I started learning I was pretty good at it. And I was very patient and able to look for the pieces that I needed. So, yeah, so I got into 2006. I started over on the roadside of things. And then about 4 years into it, I knew I wasn't good at being a regular cop. Not that I wasn't good at it. I just didn't care for it.
Sure.
And then a detective position opened up. And I decided that's where I wanted to go. So in 2010, I tested and I became a detective for the major crimes unit. And that's where we focused. I mean, you kind of had a whole array of things, but we focused on murder and kidnapping and burglary and robbery and child sex. Yeah. And unfortunately, child sex was probably about 75% of my caseload.
Jeez.
And yeah, it's alarming numbers, like how often that stuff happens. And then talking to a lot of those victims, I realized I had a unique connection with them because it was hard for them to talk about it. So sometimes I would bring in my own story and tell them, you know, this is very hard to do. And I understand that. And I could connect with them and it helped with the investigations. 2018 came around and I had an opportunity to test for the ICAC position, the Internet Crimes Against Children. I knew I wanted more specialty training and I already had some experience with it, doing major crimes, and I tested for it, and that's where I've been for the last 5 years.
That's incredible. And what I was loving to hear is being that person that has been on both sides of the fence, hearing about someone being sexually abused, but also being sexually abused, that level of empathy and that level of connection and just a kind, warm presence, it can just really make a difference to a person on their worst day.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of weird. It's you know, because I, you know, and I've been told quit belittling my situation because, you know, I heard once somebody say, our circumstances are different, but our trauma is the same. And, you know, that meant a lot to me. And so I almost felt like imposter syndrome a little bit when I was talking to these kids that went through these whole horrific incidences, but at the same time they appreciated being able to connect with somebody like me because, you know, in their eyes I'm somebody that's successful, that's managed my life, that's managed my career and became something productive in life, versus the other end where you see so many people go the other route where they just can't let go of the victimization that occurred to them. Mm-hmm. And they hold on to it so tight that they're never able to do something more. And as it's not black and white, you know, the road to get to that level where you can overcome what's occurred to you, mm-hmm. it's not an easy one. And it's often a lifelong one. I thought I had a great handle on mine, you know, because I was able to talk about it. I never talk about the circumstances or the specific incident itself, but I can talk about that. You know, I was a victim of a molestation, mm-hmm. and you know it happened at this time, and I, you know, I was telling kids about it, and I'm like, man, you know, and I was able to kind of like feel like I forgave you know, the person that did it, because I learned that hating this person doesn't do a thing against them. It's only tearing me up inside.
Yep.
So I had that all done, and I'm just like, man, I'm just cruising and life's so good. And then like 2 years ago, I was talking to my unit has a, which one gives the meds and which one doesn't? The psychiatrist.
Oh, the psychiatrist gives the meds. Yeah.
Okay. So we have a psychologist that's assigned to our group. So in ICAC, we have to talk to our psychologist once a month because of the content that we see
and sure.
what we deal with. So we're just, you know, and she's a great lady, Dr. Stacy Chiquette. And, you know, what I like about her is how she does her meeting. She's like, well, I do it any which way you want. You want to have a coffee? We can have a coffee. You want to go for a walk? We'll go for a walk. I'm like, you know what? That's great. I love moving. Let's go for a walk. So we're in, I remember it was a Dallas conference, and this is like, I don't know, maybe 3, maybe 4 years ago. And I'm walking with her, and I'm like, yeah, you know, I had this incident happen to me when I was a kid, and, you know, da da da, and I've overcame it. And she's like, did you report it? And she's like, oh, you're a cop. Of course you reported it. And right then and there, I realized we never reported it. And that unraveled me. I mean, just, I called my father and I was just screaming at him. And, you know, I'm just like, why would we never report this? And he's like, well, you know, Scott, at the time we were dealing with your mom at the time. And I was being told that the CPS would take you away from me because it's, you know, mid-80s. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know what to do. And I'm like, yeah, but you became a cop after that. And I'm like, you knew. And he's like, you're right. I should have known. So it was odd because here I'm like 41 years old, and me and my father ended up going into the police department. I made that report finally. And that, out of everything in my life, that is what gave me closure of the whole incident, at least so far. We'll see how it is in another 5 or 10 years. But yeah, so it's kind of going through those triumphs and tribulations, being able to connect with kids or even adults that have gone through similar situations. It's refreshing, I think, for them and for me, because we've all spent so much time hiding our traumas or don't want to talk about our trauma, especially men. Men are really bad about it. So it helps to be able to make those connections and let people know it's okay to be vulnerable and it's okay to be hurt. But it's also, you also have the power to turn it into something else.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I've had a lot of success with it.
Well, and I love this example that you're sharing, and you kind of hit the nail on the head with me, because one of the reasons why I do bring up, not on a, Colleen, would you say it's all the time or when it's necessary, I'm not bringing up from flashbacks. I'm bringing it up now about the sexual abuse or about my past experiences, as I can be vulnerable for my own security and sanity, but also to share. So when someone hears it, they're, you know, whether it was a touch, a one-time thing, a 10-year thing, it happened.
Yeah.
And it doesn't, like, our systems don't get to discern or differentiate what was super, super bad. What was a little bit bad, what just kind of happened and was weird. It's just like, it affected you.
Yeah. Our circumstances are different, but our trauma is the same.
Yeah. You hit the nail on the head with that. And I think the more that all of us, men, women, I don't share the specifics outside of two events, because actually my brain was the department of my brain that says, well, it happened, you know, 1,222 times, was completely shut down. So I remember the first time, which was weird, and I remember the second time, which was terrifying. And then the only way that I had any framework that this was continually happening was when I was kicked up. I withdrew from school my freshman year, and I had an appointed tutor, and the man that was molesting me would come over on his lunch break, and he would molest me every day while my parents were at work. So then I was able to at least put framework as, wow, this was a really long time. And then it was just, I couldn't, there were no Christmases, there were no birthdays, there were no special holidays where it didn't happen. And then it was just, oh, it just happened on the weekends or going to get ice or, you know, there's so many different opportunities to have it happen. And the reason why I'm saying this right now is because we're talking to a specialized officer, which I'm so excited about this, guys, because we can unpack hypervigilance when it comes to this. Because we have, there's parents that are absolutely terrified. Is this going to happen to my kids? There's grandparents that are saying, is this going to happen to my kids? And we're going to get to all of this, okay? Because I really want to know, you know, are there any safe apps out there? Are there, you know, are there any safe, is there any place where a kid is safe where a parent's involvement doesn't need to be helicoptering when we're talking about the internet, when we're talking about an iPad, iPhone, any type of electronic equipment?
Yeah, no, that's a lot of good stuff there. I've done talks many times about internet safety and our kids today. And I'd be more than happy to cover all that. Only thing I would have to preface it is because I was such a crappy student. I'm not an actual psychologist or sociologist.
Sure.
I can only tell you what I see in person. And yeah. I'm glad you said what you said. You know, what you're talking about is very not uncommon, especially when I've dealt with people that have been through horrific series of sexual abuses. You know, they can remember specific instances and what connects those specific incidents could be, well, obviously the first time is usually burned in there pretty well. You know, second one, I'm guessing because you said a little bit more scary or traumatizing. I understand that. But down the road, you know, it's not uncommon for people to just come across, like, say, a wall clock. I've had an incident where a young lady was telling me, you know, I can't look at wall clocks because every time I was on that bed, I was on my back and I just stared at the clock looking for the time to be done. And I knew he'd be done and I could just go back to playing with my little brother.
Yeah.
You know, so it's burned in there and it's a lot to unpack. You know, I mean, even though, like I said, trauma is the same, I feel very fortunate that mine's a singular incident and not many incidences. So I, you know, hear what you say, and I feel awful for you. And I hope that you're doing well and you're finding your own ways to unpack all that. Cause that's a lot to unpack. And,
yeah.
But I'm seeing the podcast here. That's great. You're turning it into something very healthy and functional. So it's awesome to see when people go through something so traumatizing and turn it into something that is beautiful and powerful and helping many others. And, you know, I love seeing that. So congratulations. That's very cool.
Hey, you hit the heart, man. You're a very genuine, authentic person, and your vulnerability connects me, and my vulnerability connects me to you. So if I could, and if time allowed it, I'd give you a big hug right now.
Oh man, I gave you one right back, you know? So yeah, absolutely. Maybe one day if I get my butt over to Chicago, we'll look you up.
Yeah. Likewise with me getting to Washington State. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if you want to come down here. It's kind of boring, but you know, we'll find a way. Yeah. So, I guess, so did you want to turn it towards internet safety, or do you just want to talk about like children's safety in general? I mean, would you like to talk about the LinkedIn post? I mean, it's really whichever direction you want to go.
Colleen.
Okay, I had a quick little question for you, Scott, and you kind of touched on this briefly earlier. You mentioned how sometimes it's a little more difficult for men than it is for women. I feel like I've heard this before in talking to adults who are victims of sex crimes. And it seems that sometimes the theme is sexually abused becomes sexually confused. And I noticed that more in men when the abuser was same gender, so male to male.
Yeah.
And I could see why that's demasculating. Am I on the right track with that?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I can say for me, for example, you know, I didn't know it at the time. To start off, I would say that it's culture, right? I mean, men are raised to be men. I mean, especially, you know, X generation men, or maybe even some older millennial generation men, where we were learning from our boomers and the ones before that, you know, men don't cry. You know, you get an owie, you stand up, you rub some dirt in it. And, you know, if you got a problem, you duke it out. Or, you know, if you hug a guy, that's gay. You know, right. I mean, there's all these stereotypes where, you know, whether we chose to believe it or not, it's still ingrained in us in a certain way. So, I mean, Jason, I can't say for you. I know for me, it was a lot to deal with, you know, because my first sexual experience was with a man.
Yeah.
You know, and you can't take that away from me. I mean, that was, granted, I was 3-4 years old, but still it was with a man. So what happened? I became hypersexualized. I wanted to prove to myself and, you know, but in my brain, I didn't want to be a faggot because that's what all I heard my friends were saying. That's what that's what the word they would use. And I didn't want to be considered that guy. So I would go out of my way to have as many sexual relationships with as women as I could. And it probably created massive flaws in my personal relationships. I hate to admit it. I'm 2-time divorcee. But again, I didn't realize about a lot of this stuff about me until my 40s.
Yeah.
You know, unfortunately my son had to see me, go through relationships and, you know, I wasn't, prepared, and it was a way to mask it and everything else. So culture wise is, I think, the number one thing, especially when it's sex on sex. But then again, we're also, I think America is guilty of, even currently where you're seeing these teachers that are having sex with high school boys, and they're beautiful girls and they're beautiful women. And what do you see? You see memes all over the internet. It's like, oh man, I wish my high school teacher looked like that. She looked like this instead, or whatever. And it's like, you guys are taking away the fact that this young man was victimized by an adult woman, no matter which way you put it. And you're blowing it off. No, I'm not, when I say you, I don't mean you guys, I'm just saying, like, we're all kind of guilty of doing this whole, well, you know, I wish that was how I had my first experience, or I wish I could get me a girl like that. And it's like, no, that's a predator. I don't care if she's blonde and cute. She's an absolute predator. Mm-hmm. And just because you know about this one child, how do you know that there isn't 2 children or 3 children, or how there might have been 6 or 7 more down the road?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
She got caught. So for men, for some reason, I'm not saying it's not hard for women. It's absolutely hard for women and young ladies and girls to come forward and talk about their victimization. I'm never going to take that away from a female. I think for males, though, it's just we think we're expected to be tough.
Yep.
And not talk about it and just suck it up. And if we have a real big problem with it, we turn to the bottle, or we turn to proving ourselves sexually by having many conquests, or by being a player or a dog or whatever. You know, we create these ideologies in our mind because that's the way society kind of deemed it for us as younger children. And it's not right. It's not right one little bit. And that's why I'm glad there's things like this that exist, because if you could reach out to even 10 young men or 5 or even 1, then say, hey, it's okay to hurt. And it's okay to not be a man like they think, but just be an honest man or a real man, or just you, and be of value. That's what really matters. So I think that there's a lot of male victims that are out there that just have not reported and probably will never report because of that ideology they created in their own minds.
And now, with that being said, what is... You had said a little bit earlier about the power of the report. What did that do for you, and why do you recommend that, even if a person has passed the statute of limitations, even if it was years ago? Why do you recommend doing that?
So, you know, unfortunately, and I think this is a little bit true, and again, I'm not a doctor or a professional, but I think we, all of us, humans in general, when we're a victim of something, anything, say it a car accident or a mugging or sexual abuse, we all tend to get a little narcissistic about our victimization because we're so hyper-focused on what happened to us and how we're going to get over that ordeal that we forget about others.
Yeah.
What crushed me when she said that was I realized I was only thinking about my own pain and that I failed to protect any other potentially new victims that were going to come along his way. Now, I was a child at the time. There was nothing I could do about it. But the reason I called my father and I was screaming at him is because he became a cop and he knew this and this was always there. Now, did he forget about it? Sure. You know, because I was never a problematic child. I think the worst thing I would do is like leave cereal bowls out downstairs in the viewing room. Or I wasn't a bad kid. I didn't act out or rebel. So as a parent, I think when you don't see any problem, you just kind of tend to forget about it. The reason I recommend the reporting, it was so far past the statute of limitations, is because I know about, as an officer, I know there's going to be an informational report against him forever. So that way, even though he's not going to be charged criminally, there was an officer that went to his house and literally said, I know what you did. And if you ever do it again, we'll be here waiting for you. And I think that probably hit him very close. And hopefully he hasn't done it again. But if he ever does it again, my report will be there. And if they call me 10 years from now and say, hey, Scott, would you like to testify on the counts of what occurred to you? Because we have a new victim that came forward. I'll be there in a heartbeat.
Got it.
Because nobody should be victimized by this person again. And in a way, I feel like it was a failure on my family's part by not doing something about it. And not just my father. I'm not putting it all on my father because there was other familial components that helped push it under the rug. And he should. And the fact is, I do know of two other victims that he victimized, and because we're all about the same age, and we've talked about it. But yeah, the reason why I believe the power of the report that helped so much is because I finally stopped focusing about me, and I need to do something to try to help anybody else that I can along the way. And that's what makes you vulnerable. Mm-hmm. You have to put yourself out there because, oh my gosh, you know, I'm talking to these kids for all these years beforehand where it's like, yes, I understand how tough it is, what you're going through, but I never reported it. So I was really never in their chair. I told an adult, I told my parent, but I never reported it. So I'm sitting there, you know, a grown man, you know, across the table from another detective. I'm a detective. My dad's sitting next to me. He's a detective. At times there's three detectives in this room and I'm giving my report. I'm like, and he didn't make me vocally say, cause I, you know, I'm a cop, so I know how to write cop reports. So I handed him a written report. He read it. He's like, that's good enough. And I'm just sweating bullets because I'm just like, oh my gosh, I'm going to have to say my story again. I don't want to say my story again. And so it kind of gave me that perspective as well to do it. So I think that helps me along the way. But the power is just we can't be so narcissistic about our own pain. Yes, it's important. Yes, we have to take care of ourselves. And yes, we're fragile when you're dealing with it. And again, not just sexual abuse, any kind of abuse. But at the same time, if we're not looking out for one another, you know, there's going to be more victims that are created because we chose not to say something about it, because we chose not to do anything about it. Mm-hmm. Why?
How long is the statute of limitations? I don't know.
Well, each state's different. Some states, you know, it's forever. I think with our state, it depends on it goes by degrees, first degree, second degree, third degree. I would have to see what the statute was, but I would probably guess during my time frame, it's 10 years after 18. So that would have put me at 28. I didn't report until I was 41, I think, 42. I think it's changed here in Washington, though. I think it's, if it's like first degree, I don't think there is a statute anymore. I don't know. I have the legislation keeps changing on me, so I have to always get in front of a computer and Google it. Like, what is it now?
How are these predators getting to the cookie jar?
Sure. Okay. Perfect. You know, I mean, obviously, as a society, we completely changed. I mean, before it was we had to look out for the white windowless van and somebody offering candy out of it, or hey, would you like to pet my puppy and go for a ride? You know. I still remember those commercials. Like, I find them absolutely hysterical because it wasn't those guys. It was the guys we were inviting into our own homes. Like, oh yeah, that's just Uncle Bob. He's just a friend from work. Come on in, Uncle Bob. And or, you know, it's for you, for example, it's a tutor. For me, it was a cousin that, you know, I got babysat by one time, just one time it took, you know, my mom's usual babysitter wasn't available and she took me to an aunt's house. And
yeah, no, the tutor would leave. It was my aunt's boyfriend that became her husband.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
Yep.
Yeah. So, you know, it was always those, right? So anything I've ever learned about predators or pedophiles is that, you know, let's be honest, they're putting themselves in circumstances of opportunity. You know, that's why we're seeing female teachers that are predators, male teachers are predators. We see them as doctors, cops, fire chiefs, counselors, anywhere that can put me near a kid. You know, I mean, my task force, we've busted two school bus drivers. I mean, they're putting themselves in positions where they can get near children. I think, unfortunately, though, technology has created a level playing field to where they get even easier access to children, right? Because now we can go online and be anything we want to be. We can catfish people. We can tell them we're one thing, but be something completely separate. Or we can find avenues where these children, I mean, man, they've been through it all, right? I mean, you know, COVID, lockdown, only stay in your homes. We don't trust anybody. Everybody's sick. Here's your computer, your tablet, or your phone, kids, you know, occupy yourselves. Parenting is gone by the wayside. We don't seem to get involved with our kids. As long as they're quiet and compliant, parents just don't seem to give a rat's butt anymore. And it's awful, you know, and now we got this new trend of, you know, where we're letting these kids have all these decision-making powers. And it's like, oh, is this a, I mean, I don't know how it is over in Chicago, but in Washington state, you know, children have HIPAA laws that protect them from a parent finding out what's going on. Like when I was having my son broke his arm, I have to like, the doctor's like, do you give your father consent to know what's going on with your treatment? I'm like, are you kidding me? Like I'm paying the bill. I'm the one that's here for my kid. Like why wouldn't I have consent to know about what's going on? So we really created a culture that is very opportunistic for predators of all kinds, right? Not just sexual abuse, but financial abuse or fraud or kidnapping or murder or whatever. There's so many ways now that we can track our targets or stalk or put ourselves in voyeuristic situations. I mean, it's scary. It's so scary. But I think the current trend, you know, it's not so much as the windowless van and candy. Now it's just knowing where kids hang out on sites like Snapchat or TikTok or whatever the current trend is. And how can I put myself there? And yeah, that's what we're seeing a lot of, you know, so it doesn't take much. I had a, I'll talk about this case because it's been adjudicated. I'm not going to bring up any names.
Sure. I understand.
I had two children. One was 11, one was 9 years old. And this is during the COVID era. You know, so the kids are staying home. They're pretty much being homeschooled. They have their computers and stuff like that. And, you know, it's a typical brother situation, right? Older brother is the cool kid. Younger brother is annoying and stay away from me. And they have an Xbox, you know. And at that time, what's the most popular game? Fortnite. And these kids are just going to town on that because, you know, that's how they're interacting with their friends and people that they met. And big brother is like, no, you can't play with me. And if you do go play, you can't play with any of my friends, you know? So he's just being very territorial of what's his normal.
Yeah.
Little brother is lonely, just lonely and desperate. So he gets on Fortnite and he puts it in random mode. And he collects some people he starts playing with, and he connects with this one person, my suspect. And oddly enough, think about Microsoft Xbox. When you're playing in multiplayer modes, you're connecting with people from all over the world. But this one guy was just down the road.
Oh, shit.
I mean, he was somehow it turned out that he was just like a few cities away, which he was still within Benton County. So we're not talking, it took a half an hour to drive from his place to the victim's house. Not saying he did that, but I'm just saying that's about as far away as they were from each other. And this the suspect gets on there and starts talking to the kid, and he's just, he can tell, he just knows what this kid wants. He wants attention. So what is, the kid's a horrible player. he can't shoot anything, but you know, the suspect's on there. Oh bro, man, you're so good, bro. Oh man, you're like God, bro, man. You're just, oh man, you're the best. So what does a kid do? Like, oh, a friend, somebody that likes me. So he keeps asking, hey, can we play some more? He's like, yeah, meet me here tomorrow. Okay. Oh, bro, you're so good, man. Oh, bro, you're the best. This is awesome. Kid's just eating it up because he's so lonely. And he's just, I got a friend and I'm so happy now. And da da da. About day three, suspect, yo, bro, I don't think we can play anymore. You know, I got stuff I got to do. What's happened? Kid is desperate. He's brokenhearted. Like, why can't we play? Why can't we play? Please, please, please play. Suspect. Well, you know what? I just don't know if I can trust you. But you know what? If you send me some picks, then I know I can trust you, and you can trust me because I'll send you some picks. And there's the grooming. There's where it begins. And he creates this relationship where all the kid wants is a friend. But now he's willing to do anything, and he does. He takes some very, very pretty bad photos there. There was a whole set. And then he got his older brother included, and then even his older brother started sending a couple of photos as well. So after a thorough investigation, we found exactly where he was at. We arrested him. We got him to confess to what he did, and then we got into his phone, and he was doing this with other kids across the country, other young boys. So, you know, you got parents that are thinking like, oh yeah, when I was playing video games, I was on, you know, Nintendo or PlayStation 1. There's nothing bad about it. Here you go, kids, have fun. I know you're stuck indoors. Play some video games. You'll be safe. I hate to say it, they're not safe. Wow. You know, so, you know, I think back in being a kid in the 80s and 90s, it was a little different because our parents told us, hey, I'm going to stick you outside. You're going to play. But you do not talk to strangers. You look both ways before you cross the street. If I see you doing any of those things, I'll tan your butt raw to make sure you learned your lesson. So as kids, we were scared to get tanned by our parents, but we were also very aware of potential threats. So not saying that every kid listened to those threats, but we still knew there was potential threats out there. Parents today think, well, if I keep my kid home, those potential threats can't get my kids because my kid's at home. So we're safe. So here you go, kid. Here's a video game system. Here's a tablet. Here's a Kindle because you'll just read books on it, right? No. Here's a phone just so I can make sure I know where you're at all times. It's the newest smartphone. It has all the features and functions, and I'm not going to restrict any of them. But here you go. So now I know where you're at all times. Every one of those are defeatable. So going back to the original question, technology is the playground for pedophiles. It's the playground for predators. It's the playground for those that want to hurt people. That's your white windowless van. It's right in your pocket, just being carried around with you 24/7.
What have you seen as the most proactive approach to deal with safeguarding technology?
So that's a good question. That's a great question. And there is stuff out there, and I'll go over it. But I think really the best safeguard that we can do with our kids is be parents and give them hard answers and give them things that they don't like. Because for some reason, my generation turned into this generation where we feel like we owe our kids all these things. And it's like, no, we don't. I worked my butt off to buy my first car. When I was 16, I was buying my own clothes. I mean, my dad would help, but if I wanted something specific, I had to go get it. I had two jobs. I was working my butt off playing football and going to school. It was okay to work. Our country's kind of turned it into this way where, like, I don't know how it is over there, but Washington State, for some reason, a 16-year-old just struggles to get a job because of the employment laws that have been created in Washington State. And I'm like, why would you stop a 16-year-old from getting a job? They need to know what it's like to work. So they just get put in these positions where, you know, they're not getting the same efforts or the same quality childhood we had. And we as parents decided, well, maybe working two jobs was too much. You know, maybe making my kid earn money for their first car is too much. Maybe, you know, expecting them to buy some of their own clothes is too much. I don't know why we thought that, but I'm even guilty of it. I can't sit there and point the finger because even I was guilty of it where I'm just like, well, son, I just want you to focus on baseball and school. But, you know, if you do that, I'll take care of everything else for the most part. And but still, I try to be a parent in the other ways. Like, I mean, so my hypervigilance, as we were talking about before, I was very hypervigilant with my kids. And it's funny, my son's in college now. And guess what? The one question I asked him when he went to college was, were you sexually abused and I didn't know about it? He's like, no, Dad. No, life was good for me. Everything's fine. I'm a good parent. I broke the cycle.
Crossed it off the list.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that was my number one function as a parent. Like, please don't let my kid get sexually abused. I swear, victims are so weird.
Yeah.
I was trying to get my kid on the honor roll. You're just making sure your kid doesn't get, you know, abused. I get it. But at the same time, we all have our own fears.
Oh, so you're good, because I feel the same way you do.
You're speaking to the choir. I mean, feel like the psycho hypervigilant mom, and I'm not a victim of sexual abuse. But I just had my son jump in the car a couple weeks ago at the beginning of the baseball season. He hops in the car and I said, hey, how was practice? And the first thing he said to me was, good, coach is not a pedophile. And I go, good, how do you know? That's how psycho I am, that I train my children what to look for. And he goes, he's more interested in his phone and his truck than he is kids. I go, well, I hope it stays that way.
Nothing wrong with that. I think there's some good to that. I mean, you know, that's evolution, right? I mean, if we didn't teach our kids to be scared of a saber-toothed tiger,
exactly,
they'd probably go up and pet one.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think you'd have to kind of give them some credit. So the number one safeguard I truly believe is parenting. Quit giving your kids everything that they want and quit having this belief that they're entitled to some level of privacy. And, you know, I preach that with my kids at the house. I was like, you're my home. There is no privacy. This is every four walls in every room is mine. The bed you sleep on is mine. The phone you have is mine. Everything is mine. And I try to do that as a rule, because if they ever got to a point where it's like, well, why are you in my room? Get out of my room. It's like, no. This is not why we're playing. But I've seen these kids because I've gone to their houses as a cop, and I've gone and dealt with their cases because of the reports. And I'm watching these kids just get in their parents' face. A lot of times mothers, and they're just like, whatever, mom, I want to get out of here. Give me my phone, you know, and start cursing at them. And the mom's just like, oh, honey, you know, we'll be going in just a minute. I'm like, hell no, grab that kid and start putting the and palm to their freaking butts. Let's do something about it. But we have to be parents, and we have to give them the facts of the matter that it's dangerous and what to look for. And, you know, and granted, they're not going to listen to everything. They just won't. They're going to listen to their friends, and they're going to listen to technology, and they're going to make their own decisions and their own mistakes. But I think we have to be parents first, and we have to give them the hard truths, and we have to be consistent. One of the terms I heard in the jail that I use as a parent is like, I'm going to be firm, I'm going to be fair, but I'm going to be consistent. So if I say your punishment's a week, it's a week. If I say that you lose the phone for a month, you lose the phone for a month. If I say this, this is the way it's going to be. Because let's be honest, every time you ground your kid or something, next thing you know, they're just like, I'm all better now, mom and dad, and I'm the perfect child. Okay, you can have your phone back. It's like, no. What does that teach them? That they can put on a face and an act and they get what they want again? No, we have to be stronger than that. As far as technology goes, yeah, there's a number of I don't endorse any one particular type, but there's different safeguard systems out there. There's, you know, like Bark Technologies is a good parental one. It's a pay site, but they'll monitor your children's phones. And if you ever, like, they actually do a really good job about keeping statistics. So, like, I've used their annual report several times while giving speeches, and they'll say out of their users, we've had this many enticement cases. We've had this many times children have mentioned suicidal ideologies or bullying or assaults. And it's pretty fantastic stuff. I mean, it's really interesting, but that's just their customers. So that's not even the entire population.
Yeah.
But yeah, so they have a targeting system that they're looking for keywords that'll alert the system, and it'll email the parent, hey, your kid's talking about nudes. Like, whoa, what's going on here? And you can check their text messages. I'm an Apple user. Granted, everybody has their own choice. Apple's created parental controls on their phones. So like, if you have a kid, like a lot of people, I'm just gonna get my kid a flip phone. You could do that. And you know, that's one way, but I'm looking at the cost of flip phones and I'm like, man, things almost as much as a smartphone anymore. And at least with smartphone, I can do GPS tracking and stuff like that. So with our kids, I used Apple and I used a lot of the parent control. So I shut down the app store on them so they couldn't download apps or delete apps. I changed certain messaging abilities. Like if they ever got in trouble, I strip them of all their social media. And then we use, again, I'm not trying to endorse anybody. We use Life 360 in our house, and it's free app, you know, so it shows me where the kids are at all times. And you know, and even my son who's in college, I'm like, you don't have to use that anymore if you don't want to. He's like, no, I don't mind. I like you knowing where I'm at in case I need help or whatever else. So it's just, you just have to look things up. And there's always answers out there, because I get a lot of parents come to me. He's like, well, I'm just not technically efficient. I can't even run anything. And I'm just promised people, it's like, you can go to any search engine. Google's our choice. You know, we have an acronym that says GTS, which is Google that stuff, but it's a different word for the S that we use at work.
It's a technical
term. Like, hey, does anybody know how to do this? GTS. Like, oh, you suck. Like, so yeah, you're getting on there. You're like, okay, I figured it out. Or, you know, because technology is hard and it's always changing. And especially the social media applications. I mean, that's the toughest part of my job, is trying to figure out trends and where the kids are going, because they're not, hey, parents, we are now moving over here to go talk with each other. Like, they don't tell you that stuff.
Right.
So you have to get into the, you have to go where they go, because just like the pedophiles or the predators are doing, I'm having to do as a cop, and I'm having to learn. The vernacular is so hard nowadays. I can't wait till I can retire and not have to know any more of this stuff.
All the code words?
My head. Yeah. And then when you're trying to pretend like you're a kid, and all the misspellings and, you know, grammatical errors that you're trying to learn. Yeah, it's just, it gets very tricky. But yeah, there's a lot of methods out there. Like I had one friend, very smart. Well, one of my coworkers, he moved on. And he was telling me about his router situation. So I went out and I did the same thing as him. I picked up a specific router for my house. And every time a new device connects to it, it alerts my router. And I can see, like, okay, the kids brought over some friends. Okay, which one of you has got this? Oh, that's me. And I can change it into the router. So even if their friends came anywhere near the house, their device would connect to my router. I'm like, oh, what's Joe doing there? Like, oh, we just walking by the house. Like, okay. So, needless to say, the kids don't like coming over to my house at all, because I know everything. Because, I mean, I'm the guy that spent, you know, a bunch of money for the 5-camera system with ADT. And every time the kids walk through, I was like, click, how's your day? Like, oh. Yeah. So I've kind of become that guy. Unfortunately, I'm that hypervigilant. But, you know, so I still made mistakes along the way. And I think the biggest thing I tell your listeners is, you can expect to be as perfect as you think, and you think you can be the smartest as you think, but I guarantee there's going to be a system that goes around it. And I can give you for example, a family friend of mine, family member, you know, I'm not going to bring up names again,
sure.
You know, very good woman, very church woman, has two daughters, beautiful daughters, smart, intelligent, brought them up in the church. You know, that's their life. That's what they know. You know, they even went to church school. So really the outside social mechanism isn't into their world. Mom is very vigilant. She didn't give the girls a phone until much later. She gave her oldest a phone. And, you know, anytime an app comes up, she has to be asked, give consent. So daughter comes up, Mom, I'd really like to download this game. Mom looks at it. It's like a fantasy game where you could be a princess and you're fighting dragons and nothing real special. She looks at it up and down and she's like, okay, hon, you can have this one. Downloads the game. What she didn't know though is that once you pass level 15, it opened up the chat dialogue box. And guess who got to her?
You gotta be shitting
me. No, that's how it works. So every time you think you're doing something good and protective, there's still, now luckily nothing terrible happened, but she was communicating with this guy and she thought she was in love with him and all these things. And it was horrible for her. But I mean, no nude photos or nothing like that, but still emotionally, an adult is emotionally connecting with a child.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's trauma. It's a different circumstance, but that is absolute trauma. That's her first air quote love of my life. You know, that she has been duped by some animal that wants to take advantage of a kid.
Yeah.
So again, I would just say to the listeners, you can buy every system out there to protect your kids, but it's not going to make it airtight. So when I say parenting is our best avenue, we have to express our values and we have to be able to warn them of danger. And we have to try to gear them to be ready for these types of circumstances. And, you know, with my kids, I would go scenario based. You know, it's like, for example, my boys were, I would never let them go to the bathroom alone. So it's just, I knew of a coworker of mine. His son went to a McDonald's with his mom. Went, mom, can I go to the bathroom? Sure, son. Yeah, you can. And the kid was molested by a sex offender in the bathroom.
In the bathroom. Wow.
In the bathroom. So, you know, if there's time and opportunity, yeah, there's availability.
Yeah.
So, you know, when my kids were little, you know, I could have a grocery cart full of groceries. Dad, I go to the bathroom. I'd leave the cart right in the middle of the store. And like, all right, let's go. Or then when they got older, I would teach them how to do it and go to the bathroom in teams. Like, okay, so he's going to the bathroom. What are you doing? I'm observing the rest of the bathroom. What happens if somebody comes and starts talking to you? We run and find you. Okay. That, you know, I mean, we cover scenario-based problems. And I think as parents, we could do the same thing with technology. Okay. What happens if somebody random talks to you? You know, cause we don't do that with our kids. I don't know. So what happens if somebody says hello, say hi back? Well, okay. Let's walk through that.
Yeah.
You say hi back. They say this. What do you do? Well, I do this. Would you do this kind of scenario? Well, I find you. Okay, great. Let's work problem solving. Cause let's be honest. I think our schools are failing a little bit on basic problem solving scenarios and they want to teach them all this other stuff that was fine. I mean, you know, I'm sure you're going to need calculus one day if you're, you know, a supreme engineer, but I mean, it's like, let's teach our kids some maybe basic stuff too. Like, you know, maybe create a technology 101 class where it goes over internet safety and, or, you know, add a criminal law, you know, caveat to that class where it's like, okay, we're going to go through scenarios. What happens when kids don't comply to these rules or they make mistakes and we're going to see how that affected them and create, because they're not always, you know, we as parents have a tough time today because we are competing with technology. And you could tell your kid, George Washington was the first president of the United States of America. That's not what my friend Mickey said. He said he looked it up on Wikipedia and it was Thomas Jefferson. I mean, you're going to get, no matter what you say, you're going to get battled against every time, whether you're right or wrong. Because if you say something, 10 seconds later, I looked on Google, Argentina is the country that, you know, I mean, you're just like, dang, man, I can't say anything without getting fact checked. You know?
Yeah.
So it's just, your validity, I guess, as being the all supreme leader of your children that's going to protect them through everything is getting questioned by your own children.
Yeah.
Dang it.
Yeah.
So it's very tough. But yeah, I just think, you know, you just have to keep it up and you just have to keep saying, like my youngest son, he, you know, he really kind of listened to a lot more of my stuff and he gets it and he understands it. His brother kind of went a different way, you know, and his older brother, and I can't control that. You know, we have a strained relationship and he believes that he should get to live life one way. And I'm not saying I cut him out of my life. I'm like, I'm here for you, son, if you ever want to talk, but you know, his circumstance is different, but apparently I'm the trauma that's in his life because I was a hard ass dad.
Okay.
And so, you know, it's just how things work. And I think as parents, you can hope for the best, but you have to be prepared for the worst. And I think that's what you do. You just get ready. The one thing I wish I could have changed as a parent, and I'll tell your listeners this one piece that might help you guys, create a central charging station location. And I would preferably do it in the parental bedroom, you know, where it's like, okay, kids, time to turn them in. All your devices, laptops, iPods, iPads, phones, all of it, plug them in here. I got a central station. You can come collect them in the morning. Because I didn't think about it, you know, as a parent, and, you know, my kid is waking up. He's exhausted all the time. Like, why are you so tired? Like, I was watching YouTube videos till I fell asleep. And I'm like, when's that? Like, oh, like 9 o'clock. Bull crap. He's probably up to 2 a.m.
Yeah.
Because his phone's dead 10 seconds later. Well, I need my phone as an alarm clock. Like, well, here's a regular alarm. And it's like, well, no, that one doesn't work right. I need my phone. It's like, no. So I think that would help break some of the addiction, especially at night when it's like, okay, this is sleep time. Go to bed.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I'd probably be one thing I'd recommend is we have to have time limits. And if you just give them unadulterated access to their phone, especially in a spot where they expect to have some level of privacy, I think you're more likely to get in trouble doing that stuff. I think that's where young ladies get in trouble, because every time I see a photo, a nude photo, it's usually them in a bedroom or the bathroom.
Okay.
Two areas of privacy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, girls, young girls are being asked all the time to send nudes, and a lot of them are complying with it. So that's probably my one thing I'd probably tell parents, like, if you can maybe activate that, at least at night, it would really restrict their ability to have unsupervised access to their device.
Okay.
Yeah.
When we talk about the various platforms that are out there, I mean, Facebook, Twitter, you name it, Instagram, which of these have been the most prevalent? The TikToks. I mean, when you look at the numbers and where people are getting caught soliciting children.
Yeah. So, Snapchat is, you know, always problematic. And it's not because it's Snapchat. I think it's because it's the most popular site to be on. Right. So it's the coolest playground to be at. It's the coolest spot where all the kids are at. And they built their device in a way to, let's be honest, to hide things.
Yeah.
I mean, they even have a photo vault. So listeners and parents, if you don't realize, Snapchat has a photo vault in the back. That means whatever photos they're receiving, they can lock up in a photo vault. So, and you know, I always get this one all the time. It's like, well, my kid says they know about it, but they never use it. Check to see if there's a passcode. Because if you try to enter one and you never used it, it's asking you to create a passcode. But if you've used it, it's asking for the passcode. So it's like, no. It's asking for it. What's in there? So, you know, but Snapchat created a system where it's all about privacy. And they, like, legally, they still are very restrictive on what they give us, even after search warrant. Here's our search warrant. We want this. Oh, sorry, that deletes out of our main servers, and we can't give that to you. And, now, granted, they do report when they find child pornography, and thankful for that, but they're bare minimum at best. You know, but they're not the only ones that do that. Kick is a messaging platform that's horrendous for trading child pornography. You can trade all day and Kick with child pornography. Discord, another one. If you want to trade child pornography and stuff like that, go to Discord. Now, granted, it's not like Discord said, hey, we want to trade child pornography. No, they're building themselves as a video game messaging board where you can talk about video games all day, but that's not what it's used for always. So
unreal.
Instagram, Messenger, you know, DMs, it's not too bad. They're pretty protected, but you know, we can talk about all the main staples, but you know, we can go into the back ones too. Whisper's easy.
I've never heard of Whisper. I never heard of Decord. Yeah, I never heard of Kick.
Yeah. You know, so that's what I'm saying. These parents, you know, parents are like, so what do you mean the kids don't use Facebook anymore? It's like, no, grandpa, they got rid of that a long time ago. Well, I know they like to use Instagram. Yeah, again, grandpa, that one's dead too. So, I mean, you know, this is where they're at. And then they'll tell you, oh, I just use Snapchat. But, you know, look at your kids' phones. And if it looks like something funky, open it up, see what it is. Because that's how you're going to learn about different kind of applications. And sometimes I've used my stepdaughters, you know, like, hey, so what apps are you guys into? Like, which is the big one? And they'll tell me about new ones, and they always talk about, oh yeah, this one just came out, this one, and I have to like learn all about it. And sometimes it's there to stay, sometimes it dies. But Whisper, for example, Whisper is just one where it's like random messaging, right? So you could be like, it's really hot out today. And you can either put a picture of something in your gallery or just pick one of their random weird photos, like say of a forest or bubbles or whatever. It's really hot out today. And then people can choose to like it and comment on it, or they can direct message you on it. And you can set the radius as far as that messaging goes. So if you just want it to be nearby, you can click nearby, you know, and I put a whisper up once that just said some of the effect of, my mom says I can't date until I'm 16, whatever. I had 50 dudes contact me in 15 minutes. Yeah. That's you can disgusting. Go on. You can still use Craigslist. How old is Craigslist?
Yeah.
You can go on Craigslist. When I first started doing it, throw an ad on Craigslist, like missed encounters. And like, I'm not giving away trade secrets.
Some
of my coworkers might be like, why were you saying this stuff? I'm like, because it doesn't matter, man. I mean, you're going to catch them. It's not hard. But you can put something in missed encounters like, oh, I saw you at Costco. You look so sexy in your tank top. You're much older than me. I'm just a young girl, or something like those lines. And next thing you know, 50 guys. And they're just like sending, you know, dick pics. Sorry, I don't know if there's a more technical term for that. But, and you're like, okay, I'm 12 years old. And they, you know, 99% of them will be like, oh, well, you shouldn't be posting on here. And they go away. But I'm like, maybe you should just say hello first before you send a picture of your wiener online. But then you still get 1% that's like, you know what? Age is just a number. And you know what? I'm willing to teach you some stuff. And there's my guy. That's who I'm going for.
Good.
So, yeah, I mean, it's even regular guys. I'm sorry. You know, I always talk about this when I give speeches. Women, I'm sorry that men are so gross, because men are gross. Because I've portrayed myself as a female online, and I've seen more penises than I ever care to admit in my life. And it's just like, you can't even strike up a normal conversation first. It has to be like, oh, here you go. Here's my wiener. And it's just,
which they think is attractive to begin with.
Yes. It's not an attractive appendage.
Exactly.
It's just not. It's like, maybe show a smile or something first. I mean, So ladies, yes, I'm very sorry for us men, because apparently we just think that that's how you woo a woman, is just by showing a picture of your stuff. So,
yeah.
Well, I think it comes back to statistics. Like, it's been proven over time that men respond to something physical or like a picture, and women respond to words. So yeah. They're sending out pictures because that's what they like.
Yeah.
Yeah, and unfortunately, in you're right. You're 100% right. But at the same time, women are so self-esteem issues. Yeah. They are so self-deprecating. Yep. So anytime they receive any kind of positive attention, whether it's from a complete stranger online or a potential suitor, they'll do anything. You know. So, I mean, men have their problems with this portion, but women, ladies. You know your worth. Just know your worth, you know, and you're worth a lot more than you think you are. So, you know, quit just giving it away for free, because these guys aren't doing anything good with it. I can promise you that. So
one of the things I think about is the in-person situations, the coach, the teacher, the uncle, the dad, whatever it is, but the in-person situations, with all of your personal experience, and we're definitely going to be getting into the LinkedIn post. This is kind of a preface to get to that. How would you prepare parents, caretakers, individuals that are for the best interest of their children and not molesting them and them not being molested? How would you recommend them to interact with coaches, with teachers, with people that are in their child's day-to-day environment?
Okay, so I'm just making sure I understand the question correctly. So you're talking about, how do we empower our kids to be ready for that type of confrontation? Or are we talking about, how do we tell adults to be ready for a potential complication in their children's lives.
How do you safeguard your children against anybody that they're going to come in contact with?
Yeah, right. That's a good one. So I think, you know, as much as I picked on the ladies as far as having self-esteem issues and self-worth issues as far as who they are as people, I think it goes with fellas too. I just think that guys just tend to act a little bit more bravado about it. You know, it's like, nah, you ain't getting me, but, you know, I mean, that sort of stuff. But when the real time comes, you know, how do we know that our kids aren't going to shut down and go with whatever they say? I always try to tell my kids or kids that I've worked with or even kids that I've talked to, it's okay to question the situation. I don't care how authoritative they may seem in your life, but it's okay to ask questions. You know, so for example, the coach, you know, it's like, hey, it's time to hit the showers. It's like, coach, everybody's gone home for the day. There's nobody here. And it's like, well, you smell, so you need to go take a shower. It's like, well, I'll do that when I get home. You know, you need to, like, again, it might be that problem solving scenario where you're going through scenarios with your kids where it's like, hey, if a teacher or a coach or somebody, an adult authoritative figure said this, what would you do? Well, I tell them, no, well, expand on that. Well, I would question it. There you go. That's what I want to get to. I want you to question the scenario. If you're not verbalizing it, make sure that you can at least question it in your mind. You know, it's like, wait a minute, nobody's here and the coach wants me to take a shower. This doesn't seem right. But I always try to tell kids, it's okay to question an adult. It's okay to question it. It's not okay to be disrespectful, you know, unless you have to be, but it's okay to question it.
I love that.
And if they continue to be insist, then it's okay to be firm. And it's like, you know what, coach, I said no, you know, because I think that's what predators are looking for. They're looking for kids that are unsure, that don't feel like they have the right to say no, that feel like that they have to listen to what the authority figure says. And, but, you know, obviously know your situation. You know, I mean, if you got two armed officers pointing a gun at you, you might not want to question it right off the bat. You might want to comply to the orders
a little bit. Yeah.
Ask your questions when you get a chance. You know, it's like, hey, sir, may I ask you a question, please, at this point? You know, I don't know. I just know your spot, right? If you're guilty of something, and you're getting about ready to get expelled or punished for it, you might want to hold the questions until the end, you know, just know your scenario. But I think I always try to tell kids, it's okay to question adults, because I think too many years have gone by where we've told our kids, you don't question an adult, you don't question an authority figure, you do what you're told, you know, and move out. And it's like, no, that's got too many kids in trouble. That's got too many people in trouble. We have to question our scenario and our situation. And I would apply that to adults as well, you know, in real life scenario. You're in a town that you don't know. Siri or Apple or Google is twisting you around with the directions and is telling you to go down a dark alley to get to the next location. You should be questioning that application. Like, you know, that doesn't look real safe. Yeah. Maybe I just need to move my way to a different open area, or maybe I need to jump to a different app and see if I can get better directions. But just don't be a lemming, you know, don't be a sheep that's just going to follow blindly. Question it, you know, take the time to question it. So I think as parents and adults, I think, and even teachers should be teaching kids, it's okay to question adults. It's okay to question authority figures, as long as you're being respectful and kind about it and it's legitimate. But yeah, I mean, if it's done by force, what are you going to do?
Right.
You know,
that's a different ball game.
That's a different ball game. You know, if it's done by force, the only name in that game is to come out of it alive.
Yeah.
And be patient and just hold in there and hold strong and you'll get your chance to report. But, you know, just come out of it alive. That's the big one. So, yeah, I think that's what we got to tell our kids is just it's okay to question. Just be respectful.
If a child does come to a parent and they're not saying anything, when you've come and you've seen these children that have been involved in these heinous situations, what type of personality characteristics are you seeing? What emotional characteristics are you seeing where maybe the parent could be like, man, something's not right with my child. They're acting this way or they're acting this way. Or are there any tattletales that really stick out?
So in the corrections, we call it baseline behavior, right? So you get to know somebody, even somebody you work with, your children, whatever, you know how they act, right? From A to B, this is how they normally wake up. They're usually sour and cranky, and then they're happy by afternoon, and they like to wear bright colors, and they listen to this kind of music and stuff like that. Obviously, if anything upsets the baseline behavior, I think you have to intervene and try to figure out what's going on. Can't bully your way in there, but you know, you have to keep telling your kids, hey, you know what? I'm here. I'd love to hear you. No matter what it is, you're not going to get in trouble. I'm just here as your friend at this time. Like, what do you need me to know? I mean, it's not always going to be sexual abuse. It could be like, I had a big fight with my boyfriend and he just doesn't like me anymore. You don't know what the case is.
Yeah.
But I think if you just monitor your children's behavior, like if they're wearing all colors and then one day they just want to wear black and dark makeup, is this a fad change, or did something happen in their life where they feel melancholy, or you know, did their favorite pet die and now they just want to goth out, or did they get touched and they don't know how to express themselves other than by portraying this version of themselves? So I would recommend knowing your people, you know their baseline behavior, know how they normally act, and keep an eye open for big changes, because it's not normal.
Yeah. This has absolutely been eye-opening, incredible, and we're just at the tip of the iceberg, because now we got to talk about the LinkedIn post. I'm on LinkedIn. And I see this. I see this picture of it. It just looked like a father and a daughter, and the dad is walking the daughter down the aisle. And I look at this write up, and I had tears coming out of my eyes. And it was cathartic. It was beautiful. It was so freaking powerful. Can you please tell us about this?
Sure. Absolutely. Just so I can preface it correctly, I just want to give a little backstory of this. So I wrote this thing up. Again, I was only expecting to maybe reach 30, 50 people. Officers is kind of what I was targeting initially. And it just exploded. And somebody commented on there, and I read it, and they're like, hey, that's a beautiful story. Did you tell your daughter about the post? It's like, no, I didn't think about it. Cause I'm like, I didn't put her name in there. I didn't put the circumstance. So for your listeners, I did talk to my daughter about it, and she knows about the podcast, and she knows I'm going to talk about it. So I just want to make sure, you know,
cool,
I didn't violate any trust on this. I did tell her, I don't plan on going into specifics of, like we talked about, I'm not going to talk about the specific traumas.
It's not needed.
So I'll refer by her first name, Kirsty. I started detectives in 2010. And honestly, my case with her was 2011. So wow. I'm a baby detective. And how it works is, you know, jurisdictions are within a county, right? So Benton County is a county jurisdiction. And city of Kennewick is a jurisdiction, and Richland PD is a jurisdiction, and Prosser PD is a jurisdiction. So they all fit within Benton County. So this Kirsty went to school at Kennewick High School, and she was assigned a paper. And she was assigned a paper that, you know, it was supposed to be about a book that she wrote. And what she ended up doing was she reported what was going on with her to that paper. She had a lot of trust for that teacher. She loved that teacher. And she wrote a very long paper about all the abuse that occurred to her. So Kirsty's familial situation was a little odd. Her mother at that time was addicted to drugs, and her father was kind of not in the picture at all. So she went to go live with her grandmother in the city of Kennewick. Meanwhile, her grandmother also had an older cousin residing at the residence, because he also had a familial situation that wasn't good for him either. So grandma had these two kids for a number of years. I think she started living there when she was approximately 6 years of age, and the abuse was immediate with the older cousin, and it started right off the bat. And I won't go into details about it, but a number of the situations were by force. They weren't even, you know, so it was very problematic for her. And so she wrote the paper up. She wrote the story about how it all occurred. She mentioned, like we talked about earlier, she mentioned specifically certain situations, but not all of them, because there was probably too many to count over that course of time. But they stopped happening when she was about 14 years of age, and she was 16 years of age at the time she wrote the paper. So the paper initially goes to the Kennewick, and I love my brothers and sisters over at Kennewick, but you know, they kind of read through it and they're like, oh wait, the first incident that technically happened out in Benton County, so we're going to give it to Benton County. And it was like, okay, so guess what, Scott, here's your first like real big case. And I'm like, okay, I'm put me in, coach, I'm ready to go. And how we do things is, because you know, at this point you don't really get physical evidence, you know, because it's a he said, she said. That's what we have.
Yeah.
You know? So we have to sell a case where it's going to be this person's statement against another person's statement. So we do what's called a forensic interview first. And we take the child and we put him before a counselor type person. It's not a cop. We use Kids Haven or Support Advocacy Resource Center in Kennewick. And we have a wonderful forensic interviewer. Her name's Mari. And she's done hundreds, probably thousands of these interviews. Wow. So it's what we call a soft room, very colorful for kids. They got coloring books and chairs, and they just talk. And that's where they just do a complete unadulterated interview of what occurred. So Kirstie pretty much laid it all out there, and I get to witness the interview through that time it was a glass window. Now they moved it up to video. And so the officer or detective can be there watching the interview. And I just watched her, and what she was describing, I'm like, no, she has firsthand knowledge. This isn't fake. You know, cause sometimes you see false reports. Sometimes, yeah. A lot of times it's marital custody issues where it's like, yes, then my father penetrated me with his, you know, it's like, there's no way a 4-year-old's going to use the word penetrated.
Right.
You know?
So right. Right.
You start questioning what's being said, and it could be coaching or is it this or that, but her terminology was very specific, and how she was able to describe certain feelings and appearances and looks and smells and, you know, her emotions while she was going through it. Without a doubt. Yeah. This girl been through it. You know, she's been through it. Kirstie has always been super intelligent, great student, unlike me. She's been, you know, she's usually in the honor roll. She's kicking butt. But when I met her, what does she look like? She looks like the punk rock alternative goth girl. And I hate to say this, but, you know, I might get in trouble for it. I don't know. But I know sometimes our prosecutors will look at the kid and they say, well, they're not going to make a good victim on the stand, man. No jury's going to believe that this punk rock, dirty, filthy looking kid has been abused. And it's like, okay. So before I even went that route, I'm like, I know she's gone through it, and I know what she looks like. How do I change the perception of this case? Cause what she's been through is awful.
Yes.
This person does not deserve to see the light of day after this one. So I devised an idea. You know, she went back to her life. I went through and did surveillance. I took pictures of all the different residences that these events occurred at. And I started building my book. And, you know, I made sure I took pictures of that. Then I went through the school districts, and I took pictures from when she was a student at the various ages. Because I wanted the jury to see, this is what she looked like when she was 6 years old.
Yeah.
This is what she looked like when she was 8. This is what she looked like when she was 10. And to do a lot of that, I had to like kind of converse with her. So I would kind of just make, initially, I kind of just made some appointments where I'd go back to the school. Because, you know, you have to be professional, you know, so I want to be put in an environment where, you know, the principal could see me in the waiting room, and I'm sitting there talking to her. And I just started asking about her day. Like, hey, how's your day going? How are things going? And, you know, she's like, oh, you know, they're going good. And, you know, problem was, is right after she reported, the family turned their back on her. You know, they wanted her to recant the statement. They wanted her to, say it never happened and stuff like that. So working with her, I eventually had to put her in foster care away from the family. Yeah. And so that worked out. She knew somebody, her best friend and parent was willing to foster her. So we put her into protective custody.
Oh, way. Thank God.
For the time being. So we kept her away.
Yeah. Yeah.
And while I worked the case, I'd continue to go to the school and visit her and stuff like that. And, you know, she's like, oh, you know, I got prom and I got this. I'm like, okay, good, good, good. And I go, because, you know, unfortunately, when you make these reports, you want that justification, that justice to happen fast. But, you know, everybody has their rights when it comes to being accused of a crime. So when I tell these people, like, this could be a month or this could be 2 years. I don't know how long it's going to be before we go to the courts. So I was checking in with her. And by the time I had it said and done, we conducted an interview with her cousin and I got him to confess to the crime. So, you know, it was dead bang. I mean, we had everything we needed, had everything lined up. And but I still would make these visits with her, just like, hey, how are things going? How you been? You need anything? Stuff like that. Because I really connected with her and I just want, you know, she calls me dad and I call her my daughter. But the fact of the matter is I probably would have been 15 years old when she was born and stuff like that. So, you know, I mean, it's like she's the one that started calling me dad. And at first I wasn't sure how I felt about that. I was like, man, I'm not that old, am I? Like, so, but I kind of went with it. And I remember like right before her trial, I visited her and I'm like, Kirsty, what are you going to do after high school? Because now she's to the point where she's about to graduate from high school. And she's like, I think I'm going to go to CBC, which is the local community college, because I want to be a nurse. And I'm like, no. I'm like, you got to get out of here. I'm like, you need to leave. There's nothing good for you. And I should take a step back. I apologize. During this investigation, her uncle and another family member dropped off her diaries to my office. And they were, you know, you need to read these. You need to read these. I'm like, why do I need to read these? Like, she's a slut and she's a liar. And she's talking about sex like that she's had.
Me.
Yeah.
Through high school, you know, and she was always this way. And she was probably her fault. So I'm like, fine. And I went to my boss about it. I was like, well, you probably should read them then. And I did. I read them. And what I saw, I didn't see a air quote slut or a liar. What I read was a child that was through so much trauma that she didn't know how to fix her pain other than experimenting with alcohol and drugs and other boys. And, yeah. And she was hurting. She was in a lot of pain. And that's what I read when I read those journals.
Yeah.
And, I never saw her as, you know, they were trying to make her this unhuman EOS piece of garbage. I didn't see that at all in her. I saw a young lady that struggled hard, and she made it through. So I went and visited her before trial, and she's, you know, I told her, no, you need to get out of here. Your family's against you. You're not going to get the support you need here. You're more potentially liable to fall back into these old trends to cope with your pain than you would be to start afresh and go somewhere new. And I recommended her joining the Air Force. And, she's like, really? I'm like, yeah, you know, go see the world, you know, and go get your degree while you're in, and, you know, you'll get all these benefits and da, da, da. So she's like, I'll think about it. I'm like, okay. So I remember we're going into the sentencing portion. He was found guilty. And then we're going into the sentencing portion where she had the right to basically speak to the court before they gave out sentencing. And I see her in the gallery and I'm like, hey, sitting next to her. I'm like, how are you doing? She's like, I'm doing good. She's like, guess what? And I'm like, what? And she's like, I joined the Air Force. I'm like, no, you didn't. She's like, I did. And she's like, I'm going to be a surgical nurse there. I'm like, that's fantastic. So we went into the sentencing portion and I will never forget it. Her whole family is standing behind this guy and grandma's in the middle because she's in a wheelchair. And yeah, I could see that the grandma was struggling between her two grandkids. But the whole family was behind him, and it was me and my partners were behind her and her foster mom at the time. And, you know, but not many people were behind her side. And she stood up and man, she, I remember the judge was Judge Cameron Mitchell, and he's presiding over the trial and, getting ready to do sentencing. And she just raised up this piece of paper. She starts reading it, and she's like, you know, dear so-and-so, you know, these are through all the years, this is what you did to me. And that, and just very matter of fact. And she reads out the whole letter. And then at the very bottom, she signs it, sincerely, no longer your victim. And I was like, wow, it was so powerful. Yeah. Sorry, I'm getting choked up.
Oh my God. Yeah. That.
So, because I used to always tell her, I go, you know, Kirsty, you have the ability to be a survivor or a victim in your story. And it's your story and you choose how to write it. And she took it. And that's when she said, you know, no longer your victim, because she didn't want to be a victim anymore. So we get through that part and I'm like, okay, well, move on to other cases and so on, so on, so forth. And then a month later, she hits me up. She's like, hey, Dad, guess what? I'm like, what? And she's like, I broke my uncle's nose. And I'm like, what? So apparently she was back home and the uncle that was the father of the cousin that went to jail, he got in her face and started calling her every name in the book. And she just got mad, just launched a punch and snapped his nose. And I'm just like, well, I'm super proud of you, but this is what's going to happen if you get charged for this assault and you might not make your way into the military. And I was married at the time and, you know, me and my ex probably weren't the best marital couple, but the one thing I will give her credit for sure is that I went back home and I talked to her about it. I'm like, I got this kid and she's getting ready to leave for the Navy and I'd like to ask her to live with us while she prepares to go. I don't want her to get any more trouble. So she agreed to it and we moved her in with our kids and she just melded right into the family right after that. So we took care of her and, you know, I was much better shape back then. So I'd jog with her getting ready for basic. And then December came and that was her go in day. And I drove her to the recruiting station and I just hugged her and said, I love you and goodbye and stay in contact. So she does. And apparently now the military, especially the Air Force, I guess he gets cell phones or stuff like that. Like I was in the Army. I never got anything like that, but she, she gets through basic training and then she starts her specialty school training and she hits me up and she's like, guess what, Dad? I'm like, what's that? She's like, I met somebody. I'm like, oh, Kirsty. And she's like, no, he's amazing. You know, and she's in San Antonio. And I'm like, Kirsty, long distance doesn't work because he's Navy and she's Air Force. Apparently they go to the same school for nursing. He's a corpsman. And I'm like, this is just never going to work. You know, I mean, you just need to focus on you and that's what you need to do. And she's like, and she's just like, I don't think so. This guy's something special. I'm like, okay, we'll see. And 4 years they dated and he's over in Maryland and she's in Mississippi. And, you know, I've been talking a bad deal about technology, but the good side of technology was they would video chat every night and they play video games online together and they would make a point to where they would fly somewhere in the middle twice a year so they could visit and be together. And his mom got to know her and she built this new network, this familial system over there. And she's like, I'm getting out. What should I do? And I'm like, stay in Maryland, stay over there. I go, that's where your support system's at. That's where you need to go. So she ends up moving. He's still in the Navy. She goes over to live with his mom while going to school. And he gets out. And they get a little place together and they're using the military benefits and they're both going to school full time and they're using their post 9/11 GI Bill to pay for the housing and all that stuff. And she finishes her degree for RN and just recently, I think. And, you know, now they bought a house together and the photo that you mentioned was their wedding. And that was 10 years after the day they met. So that's why they got married in San Antonio. So yeah, she called me up and asked me to be walk her down the aisle and I got to do that. So that was very special for me.
Oh man. Yeah.
But yeah, she's the caveat to this letter, to the letter. And I heard this from my wife at the time, my ex-wife. I wasn't in the garage, but she was out in the garage with her and because they were just hanging out and she came in and she's like, Scott, you know, did Kirsty tell you everything? I'm like, yeah, of course she told me everything. And she's like, well, you know, the letter she wrote the teacher. I'm like, yeah. She's like, that was her suicide letter. she was going to kill herself. And that crushed me. Sorry.
Not at all. You're a human being, man.
Yeah. But anyways, when that kid went on to change her mind and she chose to fight and she chose to be a survivor and not a victim. And now she's out there saving lives herself every day, taking care of people by being a nurse. And she's even got into this thing now where she's bringing over foreign exchange students. She doesn't know, she's quite sure she wants to be a mom. So now she's having foreign exchange students over at her house and kind of being a mom and a mentor that way. So it's very cool. And like I said in that post, you can give me all the medal awards you wanted, all the medals and all the certificates and all the other crap. Wouldn't even touch this. This was hands down my most defining moment in my professional career. And out of everything, I gained a daughter. So it's, I'm so proud of her and I couldn't say more about her. So I'm glad you saved this to last, by the way.
Well, if there's anything that I can say is, man, you are a beautiful man.
Well, I got plenty of flaws, but thank you.
You can be flawed all you want, but when you're talking about the level of darkness that you pulled her out of with her, and you supported her, you wouldn't let her go back in. You're a beautiful man.
I'd like to take that credit, and I do. I know. I thank you. Thank you for saying that. But you know, it was her. She was something special, and she was absolutely. She was meant to do so much more. And she had a rough life, man. You know, like I was talking about my biography, my, I think maybe this is why it hit so close to home. My parents went through hell as kids and they fought their way to be something amazing in their own lives. And that's exactly what this little girl, now woman, did, you know, 6 years old, 8 years old, 10 years old, pain and torment and torture. And, you know, I'm sure she's going to be listening to this, so I just want to say to her right now, I love you. I love you, and I'm so proud of you, because she could have gave up, and she didn't. So anybody else out there, you know, that's going through that same stuff, every day you wake up is a new opportunity to do something more, to become something more, to change something more, and keep up the good fight and just keep hanging in there, because it's possible.
And I thank you, and out of respect for her and out of respect for anyone that has been victimized in any way of abuse. Beautiful people like you exist. Safe people like you exist. I don't care about your flaws. I care about the fact that on someone's darkest day, there's a person that is out there that doesn't want to hurt you.
Thank you. You know, again, I wrote that post on LinkedIn, and I'm glad it grabbed the traction it did, because cops today are so demonized and they're so just put down that we're all murderers and we're all racist. And you know, all the cops I work with, I've never experienced that one day of my career. You know, I've been in law enforcement now for 22 years with Benton County and 5 years with military police. And I've never experienced it. Now I can say I've seen cops get hot, you know, some of the conditions that they deal with. They get angry. It's hard. It's hard to be in a profession where somebody's calling you every name in the book and you can't do anything about it, or you have to sit there and take it, or you're getting things thrown at you, or just for being a person doing a job. But the whole reason for the post, and the one thing I just like to make sure to say, is that I didn't know this was going to happen to me. This was never planned. I never came out and said, man, I just want to be a detective so I can be a hero in somebody's story, or be a hero in my own story, or anything like that. It was honestly, I just wanted to help people. That's all I wanted to do. I didn't need any attention. I didn't need any awards or medals for it. I just wanted to help people. And I've done a lot of that. I've helped a lot of people along the way that, you know, stories you don't know about or you won't hear about, because I'm not looking for credit. And I wasn't trying to use this story for credit. This story was simply just to tell other brothers and sisters in blue that I have so many friends that are quitting, that are walking away from the job because they can't hack it. But I implore them to stay, because sooner or later, somebody's going to come in their world, in their orbit, that just needs somebody. And you have a unique opportunity doing this job where you can be that for that person. And, you know, it's hard to do that when you're sitting behind a computer in an office building, or you're working for a corporation, or you're just not on the streets. We see people at their absolute worst. Hang in there. Keep doing the job. Give that hug that somebody might need. Give them that hand that somebody might need.
All right. And so when we're talking about the brothers and sisters in blue, and we're talking about these individuals that are leaving the patrols, that they're leaving as patrolmen, they're not making it to detective, they're not making it up the chain, why should any civilian give a shit about that? Isn't less patrolmen better for the individuals that are saying, hey, you know what? We want to defund the police. We want to take their street power away. What? Why do we care?
Yeah, I think a lot of that has to do with perception, as you're pointing out. Law enforcement has been painted with this narrative that we're these racist, bigot, horrible human beings that are only out there to thrust our power upon anybody that we feel like that we don't like, or we don't agree with, or we don't like the color of their skin. And unfortunately, there are some of those people out there, but like in every profession, you get the bad apples. And I can tell you, with everybody I work with, I've never seen it personally. I'm not saying it doesn't exist.
Sure.
But I've never seen it. You know, I think a lot of us all have a passion to go after those that are hurting people. And we, you know, obviously cops are metaphorically the sheepdogs of the population. And we're looking for the wolves. And we don't care what color their skin is, or their religion, or their beliefs, or their pronouns. We just take out the bad the best that we can, and absolve the danger from society by taking it on. However, with this narrative, this demonizing of law enforcement, this defunding of police, you had a lot of smart, educated officers in the field. And when they started feeling this heat and this social media hatred and this painted narrative on them, their family started worrying about them, and people are, you know, getting worried about if this is really the right profession for them. When we're seeing cops being murdered just for sitting in their patrol car to write a report, mm-hmm. A lot of them left, a lot of them exited, because these are, again, smart, educated men and women. And they realize, you know what, I can go to the private sector and make twice the amount of money. And, you know, so you're seeing this mass exodus from law enforcement overall. So whenever we get a group like that of people leaving, everybody starts becoming shorthanded. And when you have groups like mine that are a special task force that's just focused on internet crimes against children, we're only focusing on those people that hurt children. The sheriff's departments and the police departments have to start evaluating. And as much as they want to keep these special groups going, like the gang task force or the drug task force or the violent felony crimes task force, they realize that they can't populate it with their men and women anymore because the main priority is the street and they have to fill those positions. So what happens is a lot of times is you get men and women that are specialized in their new task force positions being sent back to the road, having to relearn and go through that process again. And I think you're starting to lose the quality caliber of patrol officers. And secondary, you're losing your task forces out there. And with that, plus the additional laws that a lot of states are seeing, you know, cops are basically, we're having our teeth taken away. We can't, I know here in Washington State, we just had the Brady Law for narcotics being passed. We can't even arrest people in possession of hard narcotics, fentanyl, meth, heroin. We have to give them a referral form. And after three referrals, I think it goes to a misdemeanor or a gross misdemeanor. So it's, you know, is drugs bad? Yes. Is it a condition and addiction? Sure it is. But I don't see how, me personally, I don't see how handing somebody a referral form and sending them on their way to get help on their own account is doing anything for them, because the addiction is the addiction. There's something in the middle that can be done, but that's off subject. What I'm saying is that if we don't start fixing, if the pendulum doesn't swing the other way towards law enforcement again a little bit, you know, the public is not going to get what they want. They're going to get fewer officers, and anybody with an education is not going to go anywhere near law enforcement. They're going to stay in the private sector areas. And what you're going to get is the old timers that are just trying to hang on until retirement. And the moment that second hits when they can retire, they're gone. And you're going to get a bunch of kids that just, you know, lack of options or haven't really thought it out becoming a law enforcement officer, but will probably quickly leave as soon as they realize that there's something else out there. So we're going to constantly get this new guy and gal surplus reentering the field. And that's never going to be quality law enforcement for the public, because you're going to have inexperienced officers out there that don't know the neighborhoods, that don't know the people, that don't know the areas that they're patrolling. But right now, you know, we're just hunkering down and hoping that the pendulum will swing at least a little bit back the other way. I'm not saying it has to go the whole way, but officers need teeth. And, you know, if we don't have any, then we're just going to disassociate from the public. I've seen it. The officers are just like, you know what? It's not worth it. I'd rather just go park somewhere and not be seen. And you know what? If it happens, then we'll just deal with it after it happens. So you're losing proactive policing. you're losing officers driving through neighborhoods and just being a deterrent by being visible. I mean, you don't have to engage, but when a patrol car goes by and somebody might be up to a misdeed that scares them, they're like, oh, we better not do this. There's too many cops around. But I think law enforcement is starting to just say it's not worth it. And that's scary. That's scary for the public. And if the public doesn't realize that there is a good side of the men and women in law enforcement that are genuinely out there to help, I think they're going to see it in the next probably 3 to 5 years, especially when the specialty task force are gone and they're evaporated, because we have to staff the you know, patrol side of things. And there's just nobody to work the extra narcotic groups or go after people that are hunting children online. And all the other various task force that are out there. So I know there's a lot of good people out there that want it, but they're too scared to speak up for it, because right now, the current environment, it seems to be that just the loudest voices are heard on both sides. And I think all the people in the middle that want good, effective law enforcement, want the officers to be back in power to be able to control situations, they're just not willing to fight for it, because they too are also getting painted as racist or bigots, or it's so hard. It's a hard situation. So
well, and you know, just to kind of draw the line in the sand for sanity's sake, I have to say that I would expect the audience and the audience abroad to draw the line in the sand with racism. Absolutely. Okay. Let's draw the line in the sand there. Okay. Let's also draw the line in the sand with, bullying, bigotry, all of those things. Okay. Draw the line in the sand. What about these offenders? You know, I don't know if anybody has watched the Sean Ryan episode where the individual literally put out that he was a 13-year-old or, you know, a 12-year-old girl, and in 1 minute had 60 people hitting that pin, hitting that advertisement. What about them? Where do we draw the line with pedophilia? Where do we draw the line with people preying on children, and they're doing it in not a feast or famine situation? They're doing it as a haystack, and we're the needle.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and I'll answer a question with a question. It's, you know, with this new current environment of total acceptance of whatever people say they are or what they want to be, we're also now encouraging these groups of, what is it? It's no longer pedophilia. It's adults attracted to minor group now, or they're trying to soften it to where that it's okay for adults to have an attraction to minors. And as long as right now, it's as long as they don't act on it, but it's okay for adults to be attracted to minors, but just so long as they don't know, it's not okay.
It's not okay. It'll never be okay.
You know, and I'm seeing that currently going around, and it's just like, why can't we say no anymore?
I'll have to Google that because I'm curious now.
It's out there. It's I read a couple of things on it, and it's just there. It was a special group that was trying to get awareness, because, you know, we had basically when we were doing during the gay marriage time, where all the states were beginning to allow gay marriage. You know, another good thing in my mind. Everybody has a right to be married. This group jumped out and said, hey, well, you know, if we're going to allow gay people to have marriage and be recognized and everything else, then for medical rights and everything else, then we want to be recognized. And it was like, whoa, wait a minute. What's going on here? This is crazy. And it's like, but because now we're so scared to say no about anything, it seems to be still just floating out there instead of somebody just coming around saying, no, absolutely not. That is just wrong. I'm 1,000,000% wrong. Just no, 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 no. But yeah, it's, we live in an interesting time. And it's kind of funny. I'm going to jump into a different one real quick. And, you know, the other thing I can't, and we talked about earlier, I can't stand is this: a cop, a teacher, a doctor, a dentist, a coach, a man were to sexually violate a child. When you put it on the news, what do you see? You see a mugshot. You see this guy just as the monster that he is. Double standard. Thank you. Mm. Sorry. This is a horrible double standard. But whenever we see these female teachers that are getting arrested and convicted for having sex with their students, they're posting pictures of them in their classroom, all smiles, all made up, all. And it's like, no, no, no. This is one of the things I'm talking about. Just because she's an attractive woman doesn't mean she's not a monster. This woman hurt a child, no matter what you say. And, you know, even if you have, you know, and it sucks to be this kid, because this kid is never going to be able to go out through his pain. You know, he's going to tell his friends, yeah, I had a teacher that, you know, took advantage of me when I was in high school. Oh, dude, you're so lucky. Oh, man, I wish I had a teacher like that. And meanwhile, this kid could be really messed up for that. And he's going to be constantly pushed into this idea that, you know, he's lucky that he got to have sex with this beautiful teacher or whatever else. And it's so wrong. And it's such a double standard. So I find it weird that we have a culture and an environment where we're creating all this awareness for certain things, but yet we're allowing these other things to just be like, ah, well, you know, it's not that big of a deal. It is a big deal. When you have a pedophile trying to get acceptance from our society today so they can be around your children or be around groups of children, well, I'm attracted to minors, but I'm not going to actually do anything about it. No, man, that's a wolf. That wolf wants into that sheep group real quick.
Yep.
And when you're having female teachers that are having relations with students, but we're going to make them look pretty. And no, no, make them look like the monster they are. Don't let them come back out in society and be like, oh, well, you know, it was just a one-time thing. No, it's not a one-time thing. This has been in their hearts. This has been in their lives. It's still there. It didn't go away. So it's just, it's an interesting double standard on stuff like that. And yeah, sorry. I guess that I get to talk.
Well, but Scott, going to your personal experience, going to my personal experience, there is not one person. Now I'm 43 years old. There is not one person that has come to me about being molested, about being sexually abused, about being raped, that has ever once had a positive thing to say outside of the fact that it kind of felt good. That was the closest to positive. We're not talking about the self-mutilation. We're not talking about the starving. We're not talking about the physical hatred and the loathingness that comes to a person. We're not talking about the sexual confusion. Am I gay? Am I straight? Am I this? Am I that? We're not talking about the fact that this person that thinks that they were teaching love doesn't know what love is whatsoever. So now that young child that has been groomed, that has been manipulated, that this is love, leads a confused life and potentially brings more predators in their path. Like you said, and they're not just sexual abusers. They're not just pedophiles. It opens up the opportunity for more wolves of many different tribes to come in and mess this child up further.
Yeah, I could have said it better. That's 100% right.
It is not so simple as an inappropriate touch. It is not so simple as an inappropriate action. It is literally ruining these children's lives, these teenagers. It is creating a dark cloud that does not need to be there based on someone else's greed, loss of control, and like you said earlier in the podcast, their pain created a level of narcissism because it's all about them.
Yeah, well, and it's not like, and I use that word narcissism, and it's probably the wrong word. It's a hyper focus, really. You know, you're so hyper focused on your own pain that you lose track of the total damage that's occurring around you. It happens in our relationships. It happens in our friendships. It happens in even our parenting and everything else. It's events like those are what's tainting lives forever.
Yeah.
It can be a one-time deal or it could be a 100-time deal, but the rest of your life is so stained with that until you actively seek help or
fair point.
Treatment.
Which some never do, because that's one of the things that you've mentioned is it's so hard to come forward, because what's the first thing you got? You got naysayers doubting you. You got people saying, well, you know, like your own daughter's situation, she was individualized and introduced as someone who was promiscuous, someone who, you know, was putting herself out there. Damn the fact that this individual had no right whatever to be anywhere space where she was.
Yeah. She was vilified while the other one was, they're trying to make out to be a saint. And it's like, wait a minute. No, this is completely opposite. Yeah, it's tricky. You know, it's just, we're just stuck with what we got and we got to push through. But, you know, and I'll never take anything away from my daughter's scenario, but going back to men, we're just programmed. We're programmed to hide it. We're programmed to never talk about it. We're men. A man should never allow somebody to take advantage of a man. You can't ever sexually take advantage of a man. Man wants that. And it's just like, that's not how it goes. And
no.
So I think, unfortunately, we have a lot of, even I can tell you from my time in detectives and child sex crimes, the report rate for females was exponentially higher than for men. But you also got to remember the environments that we went through too. You know, I mean, if you would have took this 40 years ago, even in the 80s, it's not talked about. Even for females, they didn't talk about it. They covered under the rug. But, you know, we had the Me Too movement and then the Harvey Weinsteins and the Jeffrey Epsteins, and we had all these things, which was great. It really encouraged females to come out and tell their story, and they should be coming out and telling their story. But if I can say anything to the guys on the podcast that are listening, you should be telling your story too. And it doesn't make you less of a man. It should make you more of a man, and it should make you a better role model for our children below, because we have to be willing to admit that we can be taken advantage of and we can be made to do things against our will. And it doesn't make us less strong, and it doesn't make us less of a man. It just, we were victimized by people that saw the ability to do it in us at a time in our lives when they were able to do it. And for any guys that are out there listening that may have been victimized by a female, don't automatically listen to the crowd and say, oh man, I wish that happened to me. They don't know what they're talking about. They're idiots. Yeah. They're just complete idiots. And, you know, even if it was a pretty person, because I've had friends that told me about the babysitter, and I've had friends that have told me about the step aunt or something along those lines. And no, it's not right.
Yeah.
It's never right.
Yeah.
So just please, please, you know, like anybody else, like us, you know, you just, it takes one step at a time, and you just have to be a little bit brave, and you have to make that initial movement, you know. And it's not necessarily telling law enforcement about it. It's just being able to admit it to yourself.
Yeah.
You know, I have to be able to vocalize it. I have to be able to say it, because otherwise it's, as you've seen, it destroys us.
It eats.
It just destroys us.
It eats. And it, I've literally talked to people on the other side of the bar stool where I've come out with my story, and they've said, Jay, how did you just do that? I said, because you know what? It comes to a point where I just regurgitate it, because I had to keep it in for so long. It'll just pop out. Sometimes it does it with the natural hypervigilance. Like if I don't know my surroundings and I don't know the players in the game, first thing I'm gonna say, hey, I was sexually abused. So if you're that, get the fuck away. You know, that's one of the first things. But when I'm talking to these individuals, these men, and they're like, I never found the one. I never got married. I never had kids because I had it done to me, and I thought that I was going to be that. You know, there's a stigma that if a person is molested, oh, so now they become the wolf.
Yeah, there's always that, right? I get that all the time. So did he get sexually molested because he's molesting children? No. No, that's a popular misconception. Absolutely. It's a myth. Does it happen? Sure, it happens. But is it an automatic? Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
I'm so glad that you said that.
Yeah. You know, and the one thing I would just add to what you're saying before is that I recently heard this and I really keyed in on it. You know, trauma is the one thing that does not get better with time. You can get over the loss of a person, a pet, a sibling. You can get over something bad that's happened to you with enough time, maybe bullying, maybe depression as a teenage depression, but trauma, like true trauma. Now we're talking, you know, the stuff that gives you the nightmares and the PTSD and this trauma is the one thing that does not get better with time.
Yeah.
And the more you just try to keep it in its box, it loves to pop out at the worst opportunities possible. And next thing you know, you're watching a funny movie with friends or family, and you just start bawling like a mess, or, you know, the kids forget to do something that you've asked them 100 times, and what should probably annoy you or make you angry just turned up to volume 12, and you're screaming, and you're just like, why? You know, it's just, I'm just saying, men or women, it doesn't matter. Just, gosh, you know, find a way to get it out, you know. And I don't care if you have to cycle 100 miles or, you know, go to God or go to a counselor or go to a friend or just anybody, you know, start small. Just try to tell somebody that you trust, like, hey, this happened to me and I need somebody to tell it to.
Yeah.
And just work it from there. And that's why I think I will never recognize a group that's trying to tell me that it's okay to have attraction towards children, like you said, about just get away from me, because these aren't just a one-time incident. It's not like I touched you once, they'll be fine. No, you've tainted this human being for the rest of their lives.
Yep.
And what should have been childlike innocence, you've made them adults overnight, and you've just destroyed them. because you gave them a problem that they're ill-equipped to deal with, and they're stuck languishing over it for the rest of their lives. They are soul stealers. They are life takers.
Yep.
They just don't care. And to me, they're just as bad as a murderer or, you know, a violent rapist or anybody else. They ruin lives.
One of the things that you had mentioned, why it can get so confusing, is because when we're talking about pedophilia and we're talking about the grooming of the child, or we're talking about the how it happens. Just earlier in this conversation, you were saying, you know, the guy gets on, he's like, oh, you know, the kid's playing the video games and he's doing dog shit. He's like, oh, bro, you're so good. You're so awesome. Okay, well, guess what? Guess what that little bit of grooming did, those games, to break those barriers. Anytime that child receives an award, anytime that child receives vindication, guess what? They're not going to accept it. They're not going to want it. They're not going to want to do anything with it. In fact, what we're creating is people that would go so far the opposite direction because they're looking for the threat at a subconscious level.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and I mean, I've followed up with the family during the court and stuff like that. And you got to remember, these are two boys that were not physically abused.
Mm-hmm.
And the younger one was more groomed and more approached than the older one. But this goes back to the trauma. The oldest is apparently, they're both having to go through therapy. They're both having to deal with nightmares. They're dealing with all this pain and stuff like that. So when people are like, well, they weren't touched, it's like, you don't have to be.
Yeah.
And this monster, you know, was 15 years enough? I don't think so. Because he collectively just stole two massive portions of these little boys' lives.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, you know, this whole family right there on his side. Oh, he's just the best brother, and he would never do anything to actually hurt a kid or physically hurt a kid. It doesn't matter. You destroy these children's lives.
Yeah.
And you're, like you said, next time they get praise, it'll probably trigger something. Or the next time, you know, will they ever want to play a video game? I don't know. Will they ever, you know, I mean, so it's bad. But going back to the original thing real quick, you know, pedophilia, sexual child abuse, all this stuff, it's been there since the beginning. It's never just recently developed. Yet law enforcement is now taking, well, before all this stuff happened, the demonizing of police and the awful things law enforcement have done to probably warrant that reaction. We were just getting into the Internet Crimes Against Children task forces. We are finally putting cops in positions where we could actually focus. I mean, we've always had the war on drugs. These task forces created the war on pedophiles, the war on adults that were trying to hurt children, the war on something that was needed to be addressed. And for years, you know, we just use our regular detectives divisions who are dealing with murder and burglary and you know, kidnapping and all those things and child sex, sure, but it was more of the standpoint, well, we'll handle them as they come in. These task force groups are finally put into place so we get to become the hunters. We're not just going to sit back and wait. We're going to actively go out there and hunt them. And because of this, and I just would say to the listeners and the folks out there, does reform need to happen in law enforcement? Absolutely. I think it doesn't matter what it is. Anything that's big business, doctors, teachers, law enforcement, whatever, it needs reform from time to time. You have to tighten things up and you have to adjust as culture adjusts. But to take a baseball bat to law enforcement because the people think everything is wrong with it and it's spoiled from the bottom up. I assure you it's not. I assure you that there is good men and women in blue that are out there helping their communities, helping the people out there that want nothing more than to serve. And there's people like us in our groups that just want to be let alone so we can go after the real threat.
You're hunting. You're in the bush. You're in the bush. Yeah. You're hunting.
You know, for me, drugs, it sucks. I hope they come up with a treatment method. I hope they can slow down the fentanyl deaths and stuff like that. But it doesn't interest me because they're adults making adult decisions. gangs. Again, they're problematic, but these are mostly adults, sometimes are tapping children to do things, which is awful. And that's why I'm glad there's those people that are focused on that, right? But me, I'm doing a job that most cops don't want to do because I was equipped to be able to deal with it, and I want to hunt. You take my group out and you put us on patrol. Can we do it? Yes, we can. Not a big deal. We'll do our jobs. No matter what job you give us, we'll do our job with 110%. But you're removing hunters, going after our most precious asset, which is our children.
Yep.
And I just hope the people understand that we need reform. We need better checks and balances, but we also need to support our law enforcement so we can continue to grow these type task forces, continue to grow these type groups, because children should have every right and ability to live their lives untarnished by some pedophile out there that wants nothing more than to abuse them or take advantage of them.
Yep. What else is there to say? I mean, this is the perfect ending to me. Thank you so much for your service. Thank you so much for your diligence, your hunting, everything that you're doing to take care of one child, take care of many children, because on their darkest day, I love the fact that they get to see this big old bear that is hunting for them. And I don't mean that from the negative characteristics, the connotations of homosexuality, the bear, da, 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 da. No, you are the protector. You are the papa bear that these children most certainly deserve. And I'm so grateful that I connected with you. I'm so gracious for your time. And you know what? Just thank you for everything, Scott.
Hey, I just want to say thank you to, I'm just a small town cop in a small town area, but you've built something beautiful here that is allowing me to get my voice out there. It's not my story. It's her story.
Yeah.
And I would love for her to, I've talked to her about it recently, where I would love for her to do presentations where she could go in front of other law enforcement members and just talk about what happened to her, or even victim advocacy, where she talks to other victims like, this is what happened to me and this is how I got through it. And she's considered it and stuff like that. So, but really, the hero in the story is it's absolutely her.
Yeah.
I just helped guide her. That's all I did. I showed her a life that could be, but it was her that decided to be brave and take a handle of it and make the leap, So yeah, couldn't be more proud of her.
Yeah. Wow. And I'm not a mind reader, but I would assume that she couldn't be more proud of you.
I think so. Yeah, I think so.
Colleen.
Speechless.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And now, just to give you a little background on Colleen, first wife of a first responder, lieutenant in the fire service. She does a lot with peer support community. Cool.
Did you say you were, Colleen, you said you were a lieutenant for fire service?
Oh, no, my husband is a lieutenant in the fire service.
Very cool.
Did I do it again?
God bless
him. No, you didn't.
I did it right that time.
Yeah.
Well, like the joke goes, the reason why there's cops is because firefighters need heroes too, so.
Oh, you guys.
The banter.
The blue and red and the volleyball court.
It never ends.
No, we love them. We're just jealous. That's the truth.
Well, man, and I didn't
loungers and TV.
I didn't want to say that, but oftentimes my response to that is, so did you test for the fire department? It didn't work out.
I always say no, because I don't like playing with hoses, but
Oh God. Well,
yeah, no, we go back and forth on that one all day long. Yeah, no, we work very well with our brothers and sisters in firefighting as well. And they're just great people. But yeah, it's like Army and Marines, man. We got to throw jabs at each other, because it's just like that fraternity or sorority. We just take care of each other.
Exactly.
I'm one person in a sea of 365 million Americans, but collectively, you're putting that voice and that message out there, Jay. So thank you for having me. And if you ever need anything from my side of the world, I'm always here for you.
So well, I appreciate you. Honor and a privilege, and anything that we can do on your side of the world to show support to ICAC Task Force across the country, consider it done.
All right. Thank you, brother.